Welcome to the Packet Pushers Podcast, a show about data networking. And today we've got kind of an SDN-related show as we look into the future, the crystal ball of some things that are coming and also the status of some cool projects and where they're at now. And joining us are going to be some great folks from Cisco who we'll introduce in just a moment. But before we do that, let's say hello to Mr. Greg Farrell. Greg, no longer in bandwidth poverty. How are things?
But still having audio problems today is not a good day, and we're not looking shiny. But excited about this because, as you know, we've been speaking with David Ward and from Cisco a couple of times, and every time it's been really educational. And particularly what I want to do is take the dirty underpants out and hang them out on the line about how we're building, you know, internet standards and SDN standards and what's happening there. And that's what we want to cover today.
Yeah, it's really great of Dave to join us. David Ward and Lauren Cooney from Cisco are with us. This is not a sponsored show. It's just we had a chance to chat with Dave, and we took it. So let's start by having Dave and Lauren introduce themselves to the Packet Pushers audience. And Dave, let's start with you.
Hey, Ethan. Hey, Greg. Hey, nothing says dirty underpants like me, and so I'm happy to be here today, and it's a shoes-off event. A bit about me, I'm the chief architect at Cisco across the whole portfolio and do a lot in standards, open source, and trying to push the industry forward.
That's great. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us. You are a difficult man to schedule. Lauren Cooney also joining us. Would you do the same? Please introduce yourself to the Packet Pushers audience.
Definitely. Hey, guys. How you doing? It's great to talk to you guys again. I appreciate the time. I think this one's going to be fun. My name is Lauren Cooney, and I actually run software strategy in Dave's organization, but also across Cisco for new offerings, new products, and bringing new things to market in new ways using new development models and stuff like that. So also quite heavily involved in open source, so this should be a really good conversation we have today.
Very good. So at a high level here, what we're going to be talking about is a bit of a discussion with Dave about a piece that he wrote in a presentation he did at IETF 91 about open source versus standards development organizations. We're going to get into a little bit about OpenFlow 2.0. We're going to chat about I2RS, network services headers, and then PCE. So we got a lot of stuff we're going to try to cover in a short amount of time. And Dave, why don't you set us up, just kind of start the conversation here. You had written this provocative blog piece, really challenging standards development organizations, you know, IETF and so on, about their relevance. Maybe that's putting it a bit strong, but about their relevance in this world of open source, where, you know, the whole big idea of code is the coin of the realm, and if you can write code that does something, then people are going to rally behind that and go, as opposed to, hey, let's develop a standard and make sure it makes a lot of sense and everybody's behind it, and then go. With that, because SDO seems to be moving kind of slowly compared to open source. Did you want to talk about those ideas and some of the thoughts you had around that?
Yeah, sure. You know, really, I took the opportunity at IETF 91 in a plenary-type talk to basically just talk about, I guess what I titled was Open Standards, Open Source, Open Loop. Right now, in the history of the internet where we are, standards bodies and open source communities really have no way of formally interacting, or often even informally. And really what's easy to see from the outside, and although I'm pretty much an insider in both communities, but when you take one step back, there's a huge impedance mismatch between SDOs and open source communities. You know, for example, in standards bodies, it's at least 2-1. And what I mean is it takes 2 years, best case scenario. And I've been involved in a lot, and some which I thought were really easy to get through a standards body. It took a little bit more time, but 2-1, I mean, best case is 2 years to get a paper standard. And I think what communities like Open Daylight proved, it was 1 year to create a de facto standard out of the code. And that's a fundamental mismatch. In addition, what's kind of interesting, just looking at this community of Open Daylight versus the IETF, Open Daylight is built using a lot of IETF standard protocols, SDN protocols, or protocols that I guess now can be part of the SDN ecosystem, like path computation element to program, TE tunnels, pseudo wires, you know, multi-layer stuff, including transport. It learns about the topology and state of the network from BGP link state, something else that's going on at the IETF. It speaks NetConf Yang as an SDN protocol. All that's being done at the IETF now. What's int- and it speaks OpenFlow, which is done at the ONF. And what's really interesting, I think, is that all of that code was produced infinitely faster than the specs at the IETF. And it has to do not just because, hey, look, if you want to get something done, nothing like just writing it yourself, writing that code and trying to learn. But one thing that I do want to draw a parallel to is a number of protocols, entire protocols, as well as protocol extensions back in the day is late 90s, early 2000s, up until, let's say, 2004 or 5 or so, code was written at the same time as those standards. And I think, Ethan, both you and Greg understand how fast in that era that BGP was going. We had communities coming out, extended communities. We had graceful restart, graceful shutdown. We had just a ton of different features coming out of the IETF, but it all showed up in code at the same time. The standards were written well. The code was written well. People were deploying, you know, at the same time. It was that, you know, what we talk about now in the trade rags, you know, the agile DevOps, you know, get it done, get it interoperable. And multiple vendors were spitting these features out. And it was really, you can kind of think of it as an arms race in those days of who could get the most critical features out so people could build their networks. Well, here we are, fast forwarded to 14, 15, and the standards bodies have really ground to a halt. There's just one last quick sec, I hear you guys wanted to chat, but there's now a kind of a default process where there needs to be a requirements document and a framework document and an architecture document and multiple use case documents before you even start work extension or protocol or whatever you want to work on. Well, that's pretty much a WTF situation. You're just not going to produce things quickly. You're not going to be able to have code written at the same time. And literally, there has been a deceleration of even accepting, you know, how to extend a protocol or how to write a protocol until all of that preliminary work is done. And the reason why it's WTF is those who know what needs to be done want to get it done, and therefore the rise of a lot of these open source communities, which, let's face it, guys, they're popping up left, right, and center. We've got Open Daylights, we've got Open NFVs, we've got Open Stacks, we've got Onos. I mean, it's just, you know, open coming out of our ears, which is a great thing. You know, yeah. I'm certainly, you know, we're engaged in all that stuff, but I mean, holy smokes, there's obviously a lot of pent up demand to get work done. And that impedance mismatch, you know, is really the main point of what I was trying to get across.
Yeah, what you're saying is the IETF spends far too much time sort of fiddling around with its own, you know, its own self rather than just getting on with the job. I mean, for me, the IETF was best defined back in 1992 when Dave Clark said, "We reject kings, president, and voting," which was a direct shot at the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, who was the government mandated body for standards, who took over a decade to create ISDN, right? And he said, "We reject kings, presidents, and voting. We believe in rough consensus and running code," right? And that was the original idea behind the IETF. Is now, as you say, the working groups and the user groups all get stuck into this, you know, examining their white paper and starting to look like the IEEE with PARs and things. But the challenge is that at the moment is that there's also a fear that big companies will dominate the discussion and that the discussion will be taken in a particular direction by somebody who can put the most boots on the ground. And I've had a lot of conversations with vendors who say, you know, as you say, Cisco is heavily involved in a lot of these bodies. You know, you've got the resources and the money to be able to put bodies on the ground and feet cutting code in the ONS or the Open Daylight and the IETF and the IT and all those standards bodies. And I wonder how much of that is a reaction to making sure that there's no domination or no, you know, domineering of the standards process to take it in a particular vision that suits one company or the other. Is that fair too?
Well, it's certainly a reputation that the IETF has. There's no doubt about it. And you can take a look at the stats, and they're published on the IETF webpage on who sends how many people. And there is no doubt there are professional standards bodies goers. I mean, that's their whole profession. And what's interesting is that that's also at odds with anything getting done quickly. If you're a professional standards person and you get your standards written quickly, you just got yourself out of a job. And that was kind of the definition of the ITU. I spent a bunch of time there as well. And look, it was pretty FUBAR situation where you actually aren't allowed to address the delegate from the other, you know, the delegate from another company or country or whatever, except through an intermediary. Look, I get it's the UN and they set it up so that way, you know, in wartime, one faction doesn't have to talk to the other or some other stuff. But I mean, we're talking about technical specs here. And if the greatest thing that ever came out of that, you know, negotiation was both XDH and Sonnet, I mean, you know, that's just, you know, a shot to the head. You know, I'm not saying
the process is right, but the flip side of it is that, you know, the advantage of that is it's very difficult for one country to dominate a vocal. You know, the ITU is represented along geographical boundaries, which is equally stupid, because if you think about it, because having geographical boundaries define technical competency, there's no relationship between the two. Technology comes from wherever it comes from. So, but the IETF, on the other hand, you know, boots on the ground, if you can hire the most people, like, for example, you know, 10 years ago, it was Nortel. They had a really large contingent of people attending the IETF and setting standards around various things. And then the MEF, the Metro Ethernet Forum, was very heavily Nortel. And then over the years, that dispersed a bit. And more recently, Huawei has got a very large number of people attending the IETF standards bodies. I mean, there's something in that for them. They get the feedback into their own development processes. But, you know, the fear I have is somebody as a client who doesn't, you know, as the Tuvalu, you know, sitting in the ocean about to be swamped by global warming. I'm concerned that, you know, there are vendors out there who are taking control of the standards and taking them in a direction that doesn't suit me, but suits them.
And I agree with you. So it's, you know, it's even potentially worse, Greg, just for a second, that companies are, not Cisco, but other companies are rumored to be paying their employees if they can become an author of drafts. That's counter to necessarily getting the technology that you want constructed. That's, you know, into that person's pocket. And what if you don't care? Then it's just clogging up the system. But moving this one step forward, actually, I think what the problem is about what's interesting and that creates a problem for the ITF is they have, hey, bring a draft to us and you're always welcome. And so it's this kind of interesting culture, which is wide open doors for anybody to come and participate. And it's obviously worked very, very well for 30, 40 years. But why would somebody from an open source community who's writing code actually want to go there? What if they're busy coding and they like doing that? What I'm trying to describe, I guess, is really that a purely one-way open door policy into the IETF versus a two-way policy where they're going to go out and work with open source communities, let's say even reviewing, did they code up the protocol correctly? Did they do the spec? How much of the spec did they miss? How much did they cover? These types of things are ways that a standards body, again, whether it's MEF, IETF, ONF, or any of the others, could actually engage the open source community as well as, and most importantly, bring relevancy of what's being standardized up to the modern era, up to today, let alone trying to go forward. If we've got the internet built out of specific technologies and it's open source as de facto standards and it's not written down anywhere and we know we need to check the security of it, the management operations, soundness of eventing, soundness of the algorithms and state machines, that is what is good about having an argumentative, if you want to think of it that way, and kind of, I guess, the classic Greek philosophical case, but to have a place where you can go and argue about the soundness of a particular, again, algorithm, state machine, or standard, that's what standard bodies do really well. But what they do very poorly is check to see how it's implemented or go and have a bidirectional communication with an open source community, and that's really, really missing in today's process. So let's talk about the ITF for one more second. They've got a liaison process, so that way they can communicate to the ITU or the IEEE or the MEF. And, I mean, that process is totally non-applicable to an open-source community. You don't, like, launch a press release or liaison at an open-source community. No, you get into the chat room, get on the email list, and
start participating. Yeah,
I think it's also an access thing, because when you really think of it, it's, like Dave was saying, it's really getting on to you know, IRC or getting onto these, you know, these forums, it's really easy to access the code. The code's available. You can usually pull it down from GitHub or wherever the repository is. But also when you're looking at, you know, spinning up things that are new and actually, you know, giving access to people, that's the easiest, fastest way to do it. There's a speed element to this too, where you really need to start looking at the speed at which you can actually innovate, and going through something like the IETF might take a little bit longer, whereas you know, putting your code up and seeing if it, you know, is something that people want to utilize, want to use, is much faster through open source methods.
But are we talking about the standards bodies becoming irrelevant because of this? Because we definitely have seen open source go crazy. Dave, like you were saying before, we've got open everything and all these major open source initiatives that have major big companies behind them and supporting them. They're not, I mean, they are resulting in products that are being used, but they are not necessarily resulting in standards, new standards being driven, particularly not with SDN, because as we're pointing out here, they seem to be moving too slow. They're burdened by process, or they don't have a lot of the right communications channels. So are we suggesting here that the standards bodies are slowly working themselves out of a job, working themselves out of relevance? I mean, Dave, in your proposal, I think you said there were some changes that could be made.
So I do agree, Ethan. I wouldn't say irrelevant. I would just say on the current trajectory, they will be less relevant. And let's talk about one concrete example. A standards body trying to define APIs without the corresponding code makes no sense. Right? You know, you're just not going to build necessarily APIs that people either want to produce or want to consume unless you're deep in the code. And right now, we're at the point, I think, where the IETF and all standards bodies have completely missed any definition or standardization of what an SDN controller is. We want to know why we've been so confused as an industry of what is SDN and what isn't SDN. It's because either on purpose or otherwise, the market and industry decided to not define it. And this is really kind of bizarro to me, why no standards body wanted to pick up exactly what is the definition of a controller, right or wrong. To move things forward, somebody's got to paint a target on their chest and say, and you know, have calluses on their calluses and say, look, here's a proposal. And what we did was, because we couldn't get the IETF, where we is, you know, me and a bunch of folks who took this to the IETF a couple of times and had birds of a feather meetings, and it was saying, no, we're not really interested in doing that work. ITU, no, not really interested in doing that work. ONF, no, not really interested in doing that work. And we're like, all right, then, we'll just go write the goddamn code. And let's see what we can come up with this. And that's led to a lot of ambiguity in the industry and a lot of confusion. And it gets really, really clear when you start talking about the APIs on top of these controllers. So I set up a couple proposals, and whether or not they're perfect, I'm absolutely positive they are not perfect, but they're things I think at least for organizations like the IETF to think about, which is they do need to reform and restructure. And frankly, part of it is not spending time on protocols and standards that are going to go nowhere. Remember that the culture is, if people want to do work, they can come there and do work. Well, there needs to be a little bit more guidance around and shoulder tap folks being like, you had an interesting idea in 2003, but it's 2015 and it never got picked up. Can you please stop working on this? And maybe here's something more relevant for you to work on. But instead, it's frickin' technopolitics. And if somebody has the desire to keep pushing rope uphill, the IETF will assume it's time with rope pushing.
I agree strongly with that. I met up with a greybeard of the IETF, and he told me, just as SDN was kicking off, and he said, SDN's a complete waste of time. There's only one way to do canonical configuration management, and that's the show run at the CLI of any box, and that's the only system that ever works. So he's absolutely and utterly opposed to SDN in any form, because it's a waste of time. And this is a guy who's been around for 30 years, basically stopping us from, you know, and I was sitting there looking at him going, you really don't want anything to change, do you? And I've seen that in real life. And I mean, I guess just to move on a little bit beyond the IETF, because this is, I agree with you, we do need to reform it in some way. The challenge is, of course, for every change that you make, you might throw the baby out with the bathwater. So the independence, the fact that anybody can bring up something that, you know, good things can bubble to the top is a problem. That's one thing. The second thing is, as you said, about APIs. So, for example, just to give you an example, in the OpenStack forum, there's a company called Cloud Scaling, which is run by Randy Bias, which has now been bought by EMC. And last week, they published the EC2 API. So, in other words, your OpenStack is now going to have the option to use EC2 or Amazon-type APIs to instantiate ES instances. So everything that you get, you know, if you want to instantiate a storage blob or a compute instance and specify stuff, you can now use the EC2 APIs to do that on an OpenStack private cloud platform. Great. But not only do they publish the APIs and the running code, they publish the test suite. So they said, if you want to go and, you know, develop EC2 suite for everything else, you can now, or develop your extension to the standard. This is the test suite that you have to add to. So if you're going to publish an API, the most important part that you have to publish is a test suite to validate that anybody else who uses the API, and that's the purpose of producing an open API, is to have somebody else use it, is to publish a test suite to make sure that the API conforms so that everybody knows it's just not random. Is that fair, David?
I agree with that approach completely, and have taken a very similar approach in Open Daylight and OPNFV, where we open source not only the guts of the controller, just keeping it simple for the conversation, but also the entire test harness around it. Performance, scaling, memory use, you know, proper use of internal and external APIs. Without having that test harness there, there's no chance that, you know, these pieces of infrastructure, which are there for an app community, that they're going to have any IVT, any integration and validation testing, that they're using it correctly, or that by accident they used the API or took results in an incorrect way, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're trying to catalyze the developer community around either a piece of infrastructure or your API set, that IVT suite's got to be there. One sec, just to kind of close off this part of the, or, you know, move this part of the conversation, in that blog, I kind of talked about two laws that emerged, and they're not really laws. They're just kind of really obvious observations that in open source, the quality and strength of that project is 100% dependent upon the interest, energy, and capability of the developer community. And in open standards, conversely, the importance, validity, and timeliness of relevant specification is 100% dependent upon the interest, energy, and compromises of the individuals who've been empowered to manage, organize, and complete the work. And those are two different goals, and those are two very different dependencies on different communities and types of communities to make both move forward. And you know, the reason why I laid it out in that kind of language was that those who are empowered to manage, organize, and complete the work effort of the standards body are the ones who are going to determine the trajectory that it's on, and the developer community determines where open source is going to go. And so, therefore, the communication that has to occur and the bidirectional, not only communication, but interest and trajectory of those two groups, there are ways to make that overlap. And that's really the key piece. And hopefully, you know, something like Open Daylight, which is so dependent upon IETF specs, right now it's on the order of anywhere from 2 years to 4 years ahead of where they are in the IETF. So, example, and we want, and Ethan, you mentioned this in the earlier subject, was I2RS, interfaces to the routing system, was a working group and an idea we tried to start over 4 years ago, and it's still on requirements, framework, architecture, and use case documents. And Open Daylight already is done with the code, you know, been shipping, you know, since Helium, you know, it actually even before that, Hydrogen, but it's been shipping the code and kind of done and moved on and just set it as the trajectory. And that just kind of shows that impedance mismatch. Mm.
I was going to say, well, let's move the conversation on and say, you know, the IETF's got problems and hopefully it's going to be fixed, and start talking about things like, you started talking about I2RS there, which is interface to the routing system. And that, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, and I never really tracked this very carefully because it went wrong very early on. The idea was to put our API on top of the routing protocols that we use today so we could use software to talk to them. Is that correct?
Yep. Given that there was no config NIMS from SNMP, there were no APIs and no way defined to work with OSPF, ISIS, RSVP, the RIB, BGP, BGP policy, all the shit you need to run a network.
Yeah, and that's right. All the things that we do today.
That's a little problematic if there's no way to control the entire guts of the internet routing system whatsoever. So, hey, let's start a conversation. Let's get this moving forward. And that's what I2RS is all about.
Now, you said there's a lot of work that's been done with I2RS in the form of code in the Open Daylight project. Can you flesh that out and talk about what's actually been baked in there at this point?
Really, what ended up happening was in the I2RS working group, it appeared kind of obvious way, way back when we started that NetConf Yang was a great way to go and build Yang data models of BGP, ISIS, OSPF, RSVP, the RIB, blah, 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 the whole shoot and match. Mm-hmm. That was the trajectory the IETF was on. This one should have been like throwing softballs, you know. It was even easier than that. It was freaking T-ball for a little kid. Like, okay, you've got this standard that you want us to use. let's apply it to this technology, which you also standardize, therefore, you know, force water drink. What ended up happening, though, was through that process, the requirements, architecture, framework, use cases, it was the working group and the folks who were writing those documents deemed it unnecessary, inappropriate, and too soon to state that NetCompiang would be the stated way of doing this. And again, another WTF moment occurs, and I'm like, look, I can argue this, or we can go write the code. And so we went and wrote Yang models for all those protocols, all that functionality that we mentioned, and now have a plethora of individual drafts on Yang models to go with the code that was written. Not because necessarily, hey, first one to implement wins the race, but paint a target on your chest and let's move this forward. The good news about the IETF is that Benoit Claus, who is the operations AD, operations and management AD, has been appointed the Yang area director for all Yang modeling across the IETF. So a few years later, you know, let's state what the IETF did really well. Somebody is put in charge of trying to get this done versus what could happen, like happened with SNFP MIBs, is that every working group defined their own MIB and a group of MIB doctors came in and tried to keep it unified. And here we are today without all operational commands and certainly almost no configuration commands currently being available to the internet routing system or a lot of the predominant features that are currently being used.
So glad somebody has. I mean, the obvious thing is I've talked to several people and there's no standard NetConf model for adding a static root to a router. There's 20 different suggestions and they're all variously different.
They are. And the one that currently is working and known to work across multiple implementations of static routes happens to be the Yang model that's in open daylight, that's been proven across, you know, the major router vendors that most people deploy.
Well, everybody went to open daylight and said, well, I'll implement that one and I've got a testing suite and I've got some possibilities of making revenue off the back of that as well. But
exactly right. And let's face it, guys like you who program networks automate and administer and orchestrate networks for a living, you know, I can only imagine you guys just ripping your hair out and giant piles of it on the floor, just saying, look, why are you guys arguing? You know, it's log onto the box, add IP route, here's your address, here's your net mask, here's a couple of other features at the end of it that I need. I mean, how freaking hard is that?
It doesn't seem hard at all.
I mean, the basic part of a static root, why not do it like SNMP and say, right, well, here's the part everybody's got to support and everybody can have optional extras, knock yourselves out. Here's a JSON field that you can put in whatever, you know, flippy-dippy bit that you want after that. So, you know, like SNMP does. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that because that really brings it back to the basics. You know, you would expect the first thing that we would define is an API to add a static root by program. But no, that's the one thing we haven't managed to do yet. But Open Daylight did, and that's become the de facto standard, which is this idea sort of validates your point around, you know, if you can ship running code with a test suite and a community around it, it will define the standards regardless of what's happening.
Dave, there's one point I wanted to go back to real quick about this Yang model. And you said Benoit Claus is in charge of that. Now, I know one of the concerns that the IETF had with Yang models is that everybody was popping up with their own way to do the same thing, which we're kind of just alluding to. So from a perspective question here, does him in charge mean that we're going to have some unified Yang models come out of the IETF eventually, whenever eventually might be?
That is his primary goal in life right now. And as an industry, that should be everybody's primary goal. If you take a look at a couple of the working groups like NetMod and a few others, a couple really, really, really basic stuff has come out. And the main thing is don't distribute it out to every working group where there aren't Yang modeling experts to try and get this done. Instead, and don't do a MIB doctor approach, which did okay, but obviously we didn't do it complete enough. And so there's got to, you know, we have to take those lessons learned and move this forward. So standard Yang models are Benoit's goal in life, and that's exactly what he's working towards.
Yeah, okay, because I think what we want to avoid is if we're going to talk about modeling again and try to rest on a standard, we don't want it to be, you know, SNMP where there's a bazillion forks in the MIB tree and all kinds of OIDs, most of which where you find the interesting bits are proprietary to vendors. Now, sure, we're going to have some of that because every vendor's got some little tweak in their platform they're proud of that's going to be unique. I get that. But as uniform as we could make those models, the better. So that's a good thing.
Amen, brother. Amen. The last thing I need in life right now is a repeat of Cops, a repeat of Corba, a repeat of M-Tozy. I mean, we do have a couple. I mean, we have a couple clues that the station's passed, and we managed to miss every one of them. I mean, you guys know even better than I do. Those things, those protocols are being used, but holy shit. I mean, we don't want to recompile everything every goddamn time we got a new data model out there.
Oh, good. Let's move the conversation along to OpenFlow then. It seems like a perfect segue. So we've got OpenFlow 1.0 and then 1.3 and 1.4 that no one's doing much with, and then there's much talk about OpenFlow 2.0, which has been kind of, it's there, it's being developed in the background kind of quietly as I hear about it. And partially that is because there's conversations happening with the silicon vendors to make sure that the next iteration of OpenFlow is going to make a lot of sense to everybody, and we have a more uniform realization of what you can actually do with OpenFlow at scale in silicon. Is that what are your thoughts on OpenFlow 2.0? Is the is the silicon integration really even a big thing? It's kind of a big thing in my mind, but maybe it's too big of a thing in my mind. I'm not sure.
Well, I'm gonna let me ramble just for a second, because I actually found it interesting that the ONF declared what OpenFlow 2.0 will be, even as an architecture as a construct, long before there was community discussion as well as code available or a flush-out spec. I mean, it's one way to go forward on a trajectory as an organization, but it seemed a bit premature to say that this is the stake in the ground that we're going to go after. But they did it, and so let's see what comes of it. But I do want to state one thing kind of clearly, that OpenFlow 2.0 is less about a protocol and more about what a lot of people think would be an SDK on top of a driver. And, a lot of people think, consider it more of an attempt to standardize what some people would call, I guess, a Broadcom SDK, if you want to think of it that way, that's on top of their chipset that a lot of people write to integrate their chips into their devices, us included, as well as a lot of other vendors out there. It's really targeted at that space more than it is actually, here's how you lay out your classifiers and your matches and your actions and things like this. It's attempting to be a language construction and a compiler that then can be compiled and then pushed into the chips, and not really about, again, that protocol that's going from a controller down to an agent or down to the chips themselves. So
when you say compiler, it implies to me, and it's abstraction for the whatever hardware is underneath. So you get an even layer of functionality across different kinds of chips, and the compiler takes care of that bit.
That is the goal, right? And a lot of folks in the industry call this a hardware abstraction layer, or HAL. Some call it, platform abstraction layer. Regardless of whether it's HAL, PAL, or SAL, really, the key thing here is it is attempting to have a language construction on top of a compiler and then jam it into some chips. P4 and P4.org, you see a lot of folks from Barefoot Networks, which is a silicon startup, working on not only the P4 code or OpenFlow 2.0, but it's also right now the only chip I know that's attempting to use this construct. So the where we are in the history of the P4 work and the OpenFlow 2.0 work and the number of silicon vendors that are actually working on it, and to be honest, there may be other silicon vendors that I'm unaware of that are working towards this. Right now, the code isn't there and the spec's not there on how, let's say, we would plug in our drivers or how we would plug in our chips. And so we've had a number of projects going on over here for several years on language constructions and compilers. We obviously have lots of chips and a lot of different devices and a lot of the same chips, used in a bunch of different devices. That's what I'm trying to say. And a hardware abstraction layer, I think I'm up to myself leading groups for 9 different hardware abstraction layers. So there's a lot of energy and desire to make programming chips easier, as there is no universal way, no standardized way of doing it today. And it adds a lot of overhead, and it adds a lot of expense to using silicon, building platforms, and then writing the code that's going to jam features into it. So again, yeah. The OpenFlow 2.0 and P4 is aimed at a fundamentally different target, in my opinion. ONF might not explain it this way, and other folks working on might not explain it this way, but that's what it looks like to me.
Right. So what you're saying there is that the value in terms of abstracting the software away from the hardware is that the chip manufacturers can run in their own cadence. They can develop on a three-year cycle. You know, it takes them 3 to 5 years to go from starting a physical chip design to finishing it and shipping it, whereas software can iterate 6 to 12 weeks, you know, months to weeks sort of cycle. We have to break away from having the two together. And, you know, big companies like Cisco and Juniper and so and Extreme are making their own silicon, but other companies are moving away from that. But we still need to have the software consistent across all of them to be able to make this come together. We get, you know, you can't just have, you know, one company saying, well, we're going to do it all our own stack. And then you still have to have APIs that I can access to consume Cisco devices as much as I can. Cisco firewalls, Cisco switches, Cisco routers, Cisco service providers, Metro Ethernet, all that stuff has to come, is converging into one box over time.
Yeah, you're right. And the that is the promise of having a hardware abstraction layer, and has been the promise for decades. That you can write the feature once to this top-level piece, it can be compiled and represented in any chip. Now, the converse of the way it's done today is that a microcoder, somebody who's writing those features into the boarding plane, needs to understand the specific resource capabilities of the chip and how it accesses either internal, external memories. Is it DRAM? Is it a TCAM? It needs to know cycle counts, how the pipeline works, where the instruction cache is available in which parts of the pipeline and how much, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is complicated stuff. It's not real easy to build these boarding planes, and that should be kind of obvious just based upon the current industry that we have. If a piece of software or compiler can be in a language can be produced that actually can create a universal HAL, which is really, really hard. I mean, take a look at how many decades GCC has been worked on, just as a counterexample, on top of CPUs, which that's the level of work we're talking here. That's the level of effort that's going to be required to get this HAL to work across multiple chips. Put it on the size and scale of something like GCC, and I think that's a good analogy.
Wow.
And as we all know, yeah, it's a big effort. And standard bodies, and let's say either POSIX or USENIX or whatever that that works on some of these pieces, GCC and some of those tools are good representations of how OSS communities are operating faster and moving faster than SDOs, kind of back to where we began. And at this point in the history of the Internet, I truly hope that we can make a turn on both sides to have what's being produced in code be standardized, as well as even have an understanding just of what is the health and vibrancy of an open source community. I mean, we saw a whole lot in the news in 2014 about issues with open source code and security flaws, and the Linux Foundation put together a critical infrastructure project where a whole bunch of big Silicon Valley companies put some money in a kitty and built, got some security experts to take a look at some of the vibrancy, health, and security issues with some of the critical infrastructure that the Internet's built out of, and the money can be used to hire folks to go and shore up that code where they may, like an entire community, maybe one or two people. But if the Internet's dependent upon it, you got to fix it. And so anyways, back to what we were saying before, early goings with OpenFlow 2.0 and early goings with the right way to build a language, the right way to build a compiler, can multiple chips be plugged into it? And, you know, I hearken back to that GCC analogy.
Yeah. So here's a question about, let's say this compiler goal, as large of a goal and as major of an undertaking as it is, let's say that that's realized. Does that make OpenFlow relevant enough to go mainstream? And let me qualify that, because it's kind of mainstream now in a certain sense, and it very much is not in another sense. You certainly can't count on it being available, and if you get it, you don't know what you're getting, because it depends a whole lot on the platform that the OpenFlow is running on, what features you're actually getting and how well they scale. If OpenFlow gets a hardware abstraction layer that's consistent, does that mean vendors are going to be more interested in it and start using it? And if so, what are they going to be doing with it? Because today it's mostly corner cases.
I almost don't want to call what's going on with the HAL stuff in OpenFlow 2.0 OpenFlow, just because you'd be confusing with the 1.0 functionality of match in action, which just isn't enough to build a network out of, or isn't enough to build a full internet out of.
No, right, of course not.
Many of others. and many of others have talked about this as well, but if a hardware abstraction layer does come out where the language extensions, the capabilities of the compiler, and the efficiency of that compiler means that resources can be used more efficiently, clock cycles can be used more efficiently, and in particular, the capabilities of ASICs can be exploited to a greater degree. In other words, use every cycle you can. Use mm-hmm. every bit of resource you can for any feature. Maybe chips will have a longer lifetime. They certainly will go much more towards generic, you know, multiple, sorry, let me put it this way, arrays of generic cores, where, we, you know, for example, we've turned our chips in that direction. And it does mean that the amount of time that it takes to, let's say, get, oh, I want, the chip currently does 3-label push, and I want it to be a 7-label push for whatever reason, you know, making up for conversation. And this can happen in a recompile. And, you know, we can use the resources in a new way to get that. You know, God bless it. I certainly hope that well, feature velocity can come out of it.
Well, that's valuable to just to try and break that down into something that people can more clearly understand. What that means is if the chips become more flexible, more universal, they can apply to more use cases. So you might buy a switch to start off with as in a data center, and it would have a certain amount, and you might choose to take the layer 3 table, the layer 2 table, and the available TCAM space and architect it for data center use, right? But if you're going to use it in the campus, you might change it to a different mode and say, I want to allocate more of the available resources into QoS functionality because I have greater QoS capabilities in the campus, or for security purposes, I might want to have more of the available memory and processing power allocated to user administration or user authentication or security functions like DHCP snooping. By comparison, in the service provider space, you could take the same chips, re-architect the allocation of resources and use them in different ways to hold different data sets, and then say this is now a carrier backbone or a Metro Ethernet chipset, and only the PHY is actually separated between that and a normal product. Is that the sort of, is that logically pure?
You know, in the end game and the trajectory that we're on, that would be the goal. And let me give you a good concrete example on how these resources could be reused in addition to what you said. On the campus, when I give Quad A access to a user of my enterprise, I would like the source to be a notion of that individual and apply policy towards that individual versus the IP address that was delegated and build these huge ACL tables and SGTs or whatever I need to do for service chaining for network segmentation. For the love of God, if you know it's the HVAC contractor, don't put them on the same network segment as your point of sale and, you know, 70 million credit cards until they get stolen. I mean, look, this is basic stuff, but if you can't do source routing based upon an individual versus their IP address, things get hairy. Now, if I take that same chip and I apply it to a broadband subscriber, and I'm able, you know, on a whatever, a CMTS or whatever the case, and now I'm able to do more with respect to their VOD delivery and network segmentation to get to a CDN better, or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I do want to be able to reuse those chips in more optimal ways for the position in the network that the box is in. I think you hit it on the head.
More flexibility. Speaking of flexibility, I want to push the discussion now along to network services headers. Now, recently, Cisco made a big push around this idea of network services header, and it's headed towards the concept of service chaining, or network service headers is the idea that there should be a tag inside of the packet somewhere to say this service need this flow, this TCP session state needs to go through these devices, and you want to tag it in a packet for that. Is that a fair summary of network, or if not, just launch it and tell me what it really is, because I can easily get that wrong.
So, no. I think you gave a good use case for what it can be used for, but really it's a context header that could be applied to a flow. And the goal here in service chaining, for example, is that, let's say I've got a virtualized router running in a cloud, and I backhaul my pseudowire, my Ethernet private line, into that cloud, and now I've got my little virtual router there, and I've got a bunch of virtual appliances behind it, load balancers, firewalls, et cetera, et cetera. I don't necessarily have to relook up on each and every one of those devices, which they do today, the source IP address, the guest IP address, try and derive who the subscriber is, trying to derive what the flow is about, trying to derive what application is being passed through me, because I can pass that context directly to them. And so that's how one example of how it's used in service chaining. But from a generic context header point of view, let's put it back on the campus, and use that example I gave you before, that if I give access to Greg Farrell on the network and I know the identity of Greg. I'm able to pass, hey, this is Greg Furrow's, you know, WebEx traffic, or this is Greg Furrow's, you know, critical database crunching traffic that he's doing, put it on the correct segment. And Greg, what we're trying to get to here is that instead of doing hop by hop, whitelisting, blacklisting, and having to configure every feature on every device in their network, allow that feature and policy to be applied directly to that contextual context header that's been applied to that packet flow. And it gets us to a different way of operating a network. Again, instead of hop by hop, every feature replicated everywhere, consistency, coherency issues, operational headaches, to, okay, tag it at the edge and apply a policy across an entire network. And that policy could be network segmentation, as we talked about. It could be directly to QoS. But you guys know very well, to apply QoS across a network, you have to program each and every device along that path to understand those bit packet markings versus, hey, if I see Greg apply it to, you know, high level QoS, or if it's Ethan, he puts you in best effort. But
well, Dave, how is network services header not just a reinvention of MPLS? Because I hear a lot of similarities.
So a couple of different ways. One, it can apply to any encapsulation type. It can be used under a VLAN, it can be used in VXLAN, it can be used in GRE, and it can be used in MPLS under the bottom of stack. So a label right now, as you guys know, only holds 20 bits of information. And generally, you guys already understand the stack. You know, there could be an IGP label at the bottom, and it could be an aggregation label, or a birth label, or, you know, or a serial wire, depending upon the service. Those define that path across the network that they want to have to override hot potato routing. You are not right now able to embed in a label context and flexibly length context. So if I want to have, this is Greg Furrow, this is his Oracle traffic, this is his critical financial data crunching, we can apply that context that then puts it into a correct network segment. It's a policy point, not a path lookup. And a MPLS label is a path lookup, and NSH is a policy context point.
There's a lot more bits there to carry information as well, not just 20, I think you said, for MPLS. A lot more in an NSH.
Correct. And currently the discussion is how to even have it be TLV'd. So, you know, it's got a fixed portion where you can apply a certain amount of context, like used in service chaining, and then some TLVs that can be added to it depending on how far you want to go. Again, my goal not only is service chaining in an NFV environment, but also with that context-based forwarding to be able to apply policy across the network. And you can use it for security, you can use it for services like telepresence or some of these other pieces, or CDN redirection, just as an example.
So just to compare that, right, I'm not, at this point in time, I'm more negative about network services headers than I am pro it, right? Because I remember when MPLS came along, and it took 10 years for the hardware to start to support that functionality. And it took another 5 years before MPLS became, oh my God, it actually works, right? And the only reason MPLS got off the ground was because the carriers could use it to turn an IP network into a circuit, you know, AND, BND, MPLS label, circuit-driven networking. Thank God we've gone back to the 1960s. I almost heard them shout it out. But network services headers means that every single device in a path has to comprehend the network service headers. Now, you could also say, well, only the devices in the network that have to recognize the label to apply policy need to recognize it. But then why not just program the state directly from some external controller, right? So there's two. I see a network service headers as two sides of a coin. You can either put a tag in the packet and signal inbound that this flow belongs to this session, and then once it gets to a device, this device says, oh, I recognize that network services header. I'll apply some policy to the packets and then send them on. Or when it gets to the virtual appliance will do something with the, you know, it might rewrite the services header, it might add a new services header, it might do whatever it is, and then pass it on to the next one. That sounds really complicated compared to having a network controller somewhere, some sort of central configuration point that says, I recognize this flow, I'm going to put its, and I'm going to add these rules into this device to do that same thing. And then I don't have all the complexity of a services header. Why wouldn't I go one way or the other?
So you could use a controller to program everything hop by hop across the network. But I do caution that, for example, today, if you're going to try and do that for every user on your network, and then you want to call out for every application flow that they have in your network, you're going to be requiring really big, heavy, resource-intensive, laden chips.
You're not going to do that with network services header either, right? because you're not going to be have that. You're not going to be able to implement that much policy. If you've got 1,000 network services headers, you've still got 1,000 instances of policy to apply. Whereas if you're programming it from a controller, 1,000 instances of policy, you've still got 1,000 resources that you need to implement that policy. Where's the difference?
Well, the difference is this. So let's say you have 1,000 different policies you want to program, but you have an employee base of 78,000 people. I would have to do it then, if I was going to do it the current way we do it, 78,000 different instances of identification of matching, and then potentially the application after it, and then potentially the policy that I want to be there. This is actually a data reduction.
But I can still use a VXLAN tag or a VLAN tag or an MPLS tag to achieve the same thing. Person comes in.
I'm with you.
Yeah, you know, why do I have to go around and suddenly make the wheel square to make that, you know, to make it go faster?
So VLAN tags, as you're well aware, have a certain space limitation and have a certain preset bits that are necessary to be used. VXLAN tags, rinse and repeat. The NSH header, its key ability is to be able to be used under any encapsulation. So therefore, if you've got a network in some parts that are done, that are L2 only, that are done in VLANs, and then you cross the VXLAN boundary, and then for some reason you've got to translate to GRE, and you've got to somehow translate to MPLS, you know as well as I do that stitching and switching at each of those points is a metric pain in the ass for configuration. Instead, if you're able to carry one context header that can be passed across all those, you're just pushing and popping end caps, could care less, and life actually gets easier, in my opinion.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm not a huge believer in policy, because this idea of saying, you know, just saying of this promise theory, which sort of says, you know, just go and do a thing, and the devices are supposedly intelligent enough to go out and work out what thing is. It can sort of read my mind. The lack of precision around policy concerns me, because historically networking vendors haven't been able to competently produce a networking device that was stable and reliable with a CLI. How are we going to see stable and reliable networks with policy that sort of goes, you know, promise me that you're going to go and implement these things and make the packets do their thing?
It does, Greg, and I do appreciate that. So all the way back to where we were in the beginning, of the conversation, NSH, when you take a look at the specs that are there, you're going to see a whole long list of vendors who have agreed to implement it in silicon, as well as stabilizing. We've stabilized here inside our portfolio that this is going to be the way that we're going to be passing context, and are now pushing it into all of our silicon. So if you've got the external silicon and system integration community buying in and building it and showing interoperability, we're doing it as well, and it's available in open source, both associated in OBS as well as in Open Daylight. And some of the functionality that I described, like providing access to somebody on a campus network and then tagging their traffic with this context piece, being shown in Open Daylight that we showed at Cisco Live Milan as well. No one can make any guarantees, and I'm certainly not throwing my badge on the table, betting that everything is going to work out perfectly, but for one time in the industry, trying to build a community around a technology to make it work, the guys who were deeply involved in this, Paul Quinn and Jim Guichard, have done an outstandingly good job to make this multi-vendor, to get the code out there and to build a community around this and build an ecosystem around it. So I think there's a better chance with this technology than we've seen in a really long time. But time will tell. And I'll give you a little bit of a foreshadowing without giving you any actual information, which is one of my greatest strengths.
Okay.
That is a good joke.
And here my greatest strength is just asking stupid questions. So please.
But take a look at what's going on at Mobile World Congress. Take a look at what's coming out soon. Watch that NSH space. And I think you'll see that this one is being handled a little bit differently than here's the latest, greatest widget coming out in the industry, and how the hell do I use it as an operator, which I agree with you has been done a whole lot in the past. This time, I think Paul and Jim have done a great job bringing everybody together.
I guess I'll remain cynical.
Please do. If at all, I can have you go from cynical to merely pragmatic. That would be a huge win in my book.
Who knows? Anything can happen. I'm dubious about policy. I can see how promise theory works for Linux, because Linux is a complex endpoint, right? It's got a million configuration options, and promise theory makes sense in those environments. And at the end of the day, promise theory logic, you know, that's used by Puppet and Chef and CF Engine and those sorts of things, is all about reducing complexity by embracing the complexity in the endpoint. And yet, a networking device is not complex, it's fast. In the heart of a networking switch or router or you know, metro Ethernet device, or that is simplicity, because they operate at sub, you know, at nanosecond and microsecond latencies. We don't have the ability to sort of, you know, in Linux, if you apply a policy to a Linux box and it stops for a second and a half, nobody notices, you know. So knock yourself out. There's no mission critical.
If my chip stops for a second and a half, if my chip stops for a second and a half, I'm dead. But do realize that, you know, when being dubious of policy is very a smart thing to do. But I do want to make it just as a very simple use case, aside from service chaining, which is usually identified with in an NFV environment, et cetera. I do want to make it easier to provide network segmentation so the HVAC contractor doesn't by accident, you know, get 70 million credit cards because he's got malware on his computer. And if that level of network segmentation can be done with this type of policy mechanism, I would love to solve that problem on the internet.
It would also strikes me that you could do an end-to-end service virtualization process, not just across Ethernet or MPLS network. You can also do it across Metro Ethernet or any other future thing as well.
Agnostic. It's agnostic to all those end caps. And again, when we had to do a whole lot of any-to-any routing, you know, back in the 90s, and you guys were there with me, if we can have any-to-any NCAP, and I don't need to listen to another conversation of why today's NCAP is better than yesterday's NCAP, is more beautiful than some other NCAP, I mean, nobody gives a shit about this stuff. I mean, or shouldn't give a shit about it. I mean, it's a freaking NCAP. They come today, they're gone tomorrow, there'll be another one the next day, and
frame relay, ATM, token ring, whatever it is.
Exactly.
Who cares, right?
Yeah, for the love of God.
Well, the packets don't flow over the Ethernet cable. They flow from client to server. They flow from one IP address to another. Whatever happens in the NCAP is irrelevant to the end goal of what you're trying to achieve. Critical, important, vital, but not actually totally all that relevant at the end of the day.
As long as the NCAP in the, you know, somewhere in the stack is IP, I will, you know, wake up every day happy. Every one of my red blood cells certainly has an IP address on it, and I don't think that type is going to change right anytime soon.
We should go back to where were we? Was it in the late 90s we were actually going to do IP as an NCAP? We were just going to get rid of layer 2. Wasn't it IP over everything or IP native? We should go back to that.
Yep.
Anyway, all right. Well, I mean, I take your point about network services header, flexibly linked tag that goes into the IP frame. There's a fixed length component for devices that can only handle fixed length, and then there's a variable length component that other people can tag it in. If you're in the enterprise, there's very, very exciting opportunities to do a DMZ right, because what today we do all this wonderful stuff up in the DMZ to do private VLANs or MPLS VERFs or policy-based forwarding, policy-based routing, or layer 4 redirects to try and send packets to this IDS and this proxy server and this inspection, you know, whatever it is, all that silliness. Network services header in the enterprise can fix that. And also in the WAN space, the same thing. We've been talking about SDN WAN. I could see that network services headers could be very useful in the SDN WAN space to create virtualization or chunks in the WAN that could also integrate with the carrier, because you could agree a carrier. Because that brings us to, you know, when you start talking about network services header, you could start to signal to your carrier using the PCE protocol and getting dynamic guarantees across the backbone. Is that a long-term dream vision, or is that just me making stuff up?
Actually, it's a short-term dream, because that code's been done. That code is written. And the convergence of segment routing, and NSH is absolutely the current state-of-the-art of what's going on in ODL and what's going on in WAN SDN. So just really quickly, segment routing is probably the most important thing that's come along in the MPLS and IP control plane and IPv6 control plane in a very, very long time. And it really gives the ability to, at each node across a WAN, not only pass the IP address associated with an interface or adjacency, but also pass an MPLS label. And just by flooding MPLS labels across the network, you've got full mesh connectivity of your label space. And you only need to program the head and tail of that entire WAN network, and you will be able to have all the functionality of TE, VPNs, fast reroute. You combine that with NSH, and you know, you really have an extremely powerful WAN SDN system. So we might not have time to talk today about segment routing, but I do think it's something that we need to be talking about a lot more. And I'd love to come back and talk to you sometime with a couple of experts just on segment routing itself.
Imagine
an MPLS network where you don't need RSVP, you don't need LTP, you don't have to have these massive Splash 32 redistribution tables that you configure that are, you know, tens of thousands of lines of config long, because you don't have this weird stitch border. Imagine if you can go all the way to the endpoint at an ASVR boundary or an EVR boundary in OSPF. I mean, these have been clusterfucks for decades, and I personally have been involved with inventing 42 of them, and I throw myself on the sword. But in this particular case, segment routing actually takes all of that complexity out of the MPLS control plane and a service control plane across the WAN.
It does. I sort of thought that it actually turns the MPLS into an NCAP. The MPLS network from the provider just becomes an NCAP, and you can start to run stuff over the top with PCE and segment routing. So,
I agree with you, and I'm not sure if you're tossing a hook in the wire to get me back on my NCAP rant, or
I'm trying to bring down the concept. I mean, segment routing isn't something we haven't talked about on the show because it's sort of been a bit far out. And I spent the weekend looking up PCE and reading up on a bunch of reports. I'll try and get some links into the show notes. So all of the sites that we talked about in today's show, I've tried to put what links I have into the show notes if people want to hear more. And I'll drop in a tutorial from a guy who does Old Dog Consulting in the UK. And he's been a key part of Path Computation Element, or PCE, and has done a couple of very good tutorials that I'll point you toward, and it explains it in 20 slides or less, what the key points that you need to know. So I think we probably should get close to wrapping this up now. So have you got any last points to make, Dave, so that we can argue some more? And let's make you promise that you'll come back when? In the next 3 months?
Oh, absolutely. Let's do it in another quarter. It will be after Mobile World Congress. We'll be after the next IETF meeting. And we'll be right before Cisco Live. And so it might be a good time because, I'm not sure if folks realize this. We created this DevNet zone inside Cisco Live now for our developer community, where we're showing off Open Daylight. We're showing off and not only our APIs and platforms and how we're trying to catalyze the community, but also it's where I bring my entire group and show off all the latest, greatest, bleeding edge stuff of what's going on in Dave Ward fantasy land, I guess, or networking fantasy land, at least.
Dave Ward, head of networking fantasy land. I don't think you'll ever get that on a business card.
Although if you dress up like Willy Wonka, that'd be great. Yeah. I'd love to see that. So, Dave, you blog, and I know you have a Twitter account and stuff. How can people follow you on the internet?
Pretty much, I would say, blogging, although I don't blog that frequently. I think, I need another overlay social network like a hole in the head. You know, they seem to be cropping up as much as NCAPs are. But basically, blogs, and then what's a little bit challenging for folks to follow me is that even though I've got speaking engagements across multiple standards bodies and forums and things like this, there's actually, you can draw a line between those dots and not come up with a unicorn. And so I pretty much kind of lay out what I'm working on, where I happen to be speaking, with what upper audience I happen to be in front of. And it's a little bit of work, but I do try and blog out some of the big points.
And you're blogging pretty much on Cisco.com, up in that blogosphere, right?
As long as the check comes every other Friday.
Okay. And Lauren, same question for you. How can people follow you on the internet?
So I actually am pretty active on Twitter. So it's at L Cooney. And a lot of the stuff that we're doing, out of Dave's office, and also new things that we see, especially around kind of software and new development models and things along those lines, which I tend to look heavily at, and new ways to ship products, as well as new open source projects that are coming into fruition that I think that people should be taking a look at. I am a very, I'm pretty active on Twitter, so it's at L Cooney on Twitter.
Excellent. Thanks very much to both of you for taking the time today to join us on Packet Pushers. Greg, what's hot for the week for you?
Writing white papers on flow management, so particularly looking at flow engines that manipulate TCP to do QoS without doing packet drops is my week ahead. And it's rekindling my old love of TCP flow and looking at the micro. That and more reading on PCE to try and understand it.
Yeah, very good. And how can people follow you?
You can follow me on Twitter at @etherealmind and hit me up on my blog at etherealmind.com. And don't forget that I've got a newsletter, or actually it's a magazine-style newsletter, and you can subscribe to that by heading over to etherealmind.com homepage, and you'll see a subscription link on the right. I'm really enjoying writing that up. It's my personal views on networking, unfiltered, because I'm a little bit stilted on the blog these days because I have to take it seriously, which is, insert sad trumpet sound.
Okay. And I'm Ethan Banks at EC Banks on Twitter. You can follow me on my blog, ethancbanks.com. I also have a newsletter, The Hot Aisle, where I tell you about the projects and things that are top of mind for me in my network engineering duties. Greg and I will both be speaking at Interop in Las Vegas coming up at the end of April. If you'd like to hear us speak or meet us in person, we'd be happy to chat with you there. Just let us know that you're on your way. Send us an email about this show or any other show, packetpushers@gmail.com. We'll respond as quickly as we can. Thanks for listening to the show. Follow us on Twitter @packetpushers. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.